From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. He was a piano prodigy, an American original, a Civil War-era pop star of the highest sort. Ladies loved him. President Lincoln lined up to listen. But say his name today and you might get a puzzled look. Louis Moreau Gottschalk. Recognize him? Maybe not. But he had a big life and a big American story. Creole composer, world music pioneer, the forgotten godfather of ragtime from a boyhood in New Orleans. This hour On Point, listening to the deep Americana of composer Louis Moreau Gottschalk. You can join the conversation. Do you even know the name? Can you hear what Lincoln heard in Gottschalk? What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Dover, Delaware, is Richard Rosenberg, conductor, scholar, artistic director for the Union Symphony Orchestra in Monroe, North Carolina, and the National Music Festival in Chestertown, Maryland. He's conducted plenty of Gottschalk, including Louis Moreau Gottschalk, the Complete Works for Orchestra, and Gottschalk's A Night in the Tropics. Richard Rosenberg, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
It's very nice to have you with us. And with us from New York is John Davis, pianist, historian, specializes in reviving the forgotten music of 19th century African-American pianists like Blind Tom Wiggins and Blind Boone. He was a featured performer last month in Brooklyn at Greenwood Cemetery in a tombside tribute to Gottschalk. His latest album is Halley's Comet Around the Piano with Mark Twain and John Davis. John Davis, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
John, dive in here. What are we hearing? What is this behind us from Gottschalk?
Oh, that's probably Gottschalk's most famous piece called The Banjo, subtitled Grotesque Fantasy.
Grotesque? Why grotesque? Is that the way to sell records in 1852?
Yes, I think
before
it was,
records?
It probably was just a clever way of getting people interested in buying the sheet music, which, of course, we're talking about the pre-recording era here,
right,
and
right.
This is how people made money when in the absence of recorded performances.
Richard, you say he was like a rock star in his day. He brought us the first inkling of jazz improv. You say a musical mix of Afro-Cuban, American slave, Colombian, Spanish, Civil War songs, late romantic genius. Where did this fellow come from?
He was born in New Orleans. His father was an English, German extraction, but an English Jewish businessman who came to the United States in about 1827. His mother was born in the U.S., but from a family that were slave owners in Santo Domingo, in what is now Haiti, who left at the time of the slave revolt in 1791. And he grew up in New Orleans at a time when there were Afro-Cuban slaves, and he was sung to in his crib by his nanny.
Who would also come from Santo Domingo, Haiti.
Yes, with the mother, Aimé. And he was exposed to these tunes at a very early age, and it became so much a part of him that even after he studied in France and worked with Berlioz and Chopin, he still incorporated this music into his basic repertoire.
That nanny, was she actually a slave of the mother who had come from Haiti, Santo Domingo, Richard?
She was a slave, but she was, like as most slaves in New Orleans at the period, they were treated quite well, and someone that Gottschalk revered. When in the 1850s he inherited the slaves from his parents after their deaths, he freed all of them. But the person mostly responsible for what he became was, in fact, his nanny, Sally.
And the whole New Orleans milieu was very interwoven racially in every other way in those days, I guess. I mean, even his own half-siblings.
Yes. Well, he had six siblings, two brothers and four sisters, from his mother and father. The father also had a mistress, and there were four additional siblings. After the parents' death, he was responsible by default, his father said he had to be, for their well-being. So most of the money that he made that he didn't know donate to charities, he used to support his family.
Creole, then, coming up very strong in this music. John Davis, you're in New York, and you have the the skill and fingers and piano right there in front of you to share a little bit of one of his with us, Bambula, Dance of the Negroes, 1846, 48, something like that. Bambula, the name of an Afro-Caribbean drum or a drumming ensemble. Tell us what we're going to hear and play some for us, if you'd be good enough, John.
What you're going to hear is the opening section of that piece, which, yes, tries to evoke an African drum and dance of the same name that Gottschalk likely heard performed in New Orleans and in and around New Orleans. Whether or not Gottschalk was African American himself, and I tend to doubt he was. Mm-hmm. He was immersed in African American culture that was all around him in New Orleans, and he likely heard this in perhaps in Congo Square, which was a square where one of the few places in the South that free and enslaved blacks were allowed to congregate and play music. And this square was just, 8 or 10 blocks from his house on Conti Street in the French Quarter.
Let us hear a little bit on your wonderful piano of what made Gottschalk a rock star in his day, Bambula.
Okay.
We've got Abe Lincoln on the edge of his seat. On the edge of his seat, John Davis, pianist bringing us Gottschalk in 2012. That right out of the 1840s, 50s, 60s. I'm sure he was performing. Would that have driven him wild, Richard? You hear John's wonderful rendition there. I mean, that the sort of romantic riffs, but then these almost, I imagine, shockingly bold rhythmic sections. Is that what made the ladies throw their garters in 1850?
Nothing like this was ever heard outside of Congo Square, unless you happen to go into the backwoods in Cuba or in Louisiana. But this was a kind of rhythm that was not found in the concert hall in any capacity. Women went wild. He was kind of like the Elvis Presley of his day. Phenomenal stuff,
John. When you're playing that, I mean, what are you channeling there?
Well, certainly, having grown up in Providence, Rhode Island, actually, and completely immersed in African-American music, folklore, and literature, yep. in addition to studying classical music, I'm sort of thinking, wow, this is my whole life coming together even today in the late 20th and 21st century. And certainly this was evocative of images I've seen of Congo Square. There's a famous image by Edward Kemble, the illustrator of the first edition of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, yeah. that's very well known. And I can sort of, when I look at that picture I can and hear the music, I can sort of imagine being there myself.
I mean, Elvis in his popularity, Elvis in that he reached across cultural, racial lines, I guess, in a land, New Orleans, at that time, where they were relatively easily crossed. It's amazing to hear now and to think how it hit people all the way back then, even Abe Lincoln himself. John Davis, thanks for that. We're going to hear more from you. Richard Rosenberg, please stand by. We're talking today about an American original from Lincoln's day, the Civil War era composer, pre-ragtime maverick, rock star of his day, Louis Moreau Gottschalk. You can join us. Do you even know the name? Have you ever heard a lick of his music? What are you hearing it? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK with an American original. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the music and life of Louis Moreau Gottschalk. You may not know the name, but they sure did in his day. An American original from Abraham Lincoln's time, Civil War era composer, and before, pre-ragtime maverick, maybe the godfather of ragtime, kind of rock star in his day, world music progenitor, people make the case, Louis Moreau Gottschalk of New Orleans. And the world, conductor Richard Rosenberg is with us from Dover, Delaware today. He's recorded lots from Gottschalk, Louis Moreau, Gottschalk, The Complete Works, Gottschalk, A Night in the Tropics. Behind us right here, Symphonie Romantique, A Night in the Tropics, Movement 1, written about the French Antilles. Gottschalk spent a lot of time in the Caribbean, South America. We'll hear about that. John Davis joins us as well, wonderful pianist and historian with us today from New York and at the keyboard. His recordings include Halley's Comet, Around the Piano with Mark Twain and John Davis. You can join the conversation. Can you hear the New Orleans, the Paris, the slave song, the Americana, the ragtime, the Latin touch? Have you ever heard of Gottschalk before this moment? Can you picture 19th century audiences swooning for this? Europeans hearing something new, Abe Lincoln tapping his foot, swinging his head, cocking his ear to Gottschalk. What do you hear in this music? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Here's Ojos writing us online, says, thank you for this program. We love him in New Orleans, of course, but not enough people know of him. He says, F. Frederick Starr's biography, Bambula, is engaging and thorough, a must-read. And Richard, John, we've got callers from New Orleans. Amy is calling from New Orleans in Louisiana. Amy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just calling because I grew up in New Orleans. We talked about, you know, how ragtime and jazz were basically born there. And when talking about ragtime, we always talked about Jelly Roll Morton and never about Gottschalk. And when I actually am in school studying opera.
Wonderful.
And in my music history class in undergrad, we first talked about Gottschalk and his piece Souvenir de Puerto Rico. And I was really struck by it because it's so much more sophisticated than, you know, the pieces you hear by Jelly Roll Morton in a way, because he is a classical musician. And yeah, I just was really amazed by the Caribbean influence, especially in the piece Souvenir de Puerto Rico.
A lot of Caribbean. Why do you think he's kind of fallen out of what we listen to? I mean, of course, people know him. People do. He's got his tremendous admirers. But why do you think he's not, I don't know, in rotation on classical music stations?
I don't know. Maybe because, I honestly have no idea. Maybe because later on, the definition of American music, classically at least, changed a lot with, like, you know, people like Samuel Barber and who else? Aaron Copland. Mm-hmm. You know, we think of more like big orchestral things with brass,
right,
instead of piano music, like generally when we think of American composers now.
Yeah, Amy, I'm so glad to have your call from New Orleans, and good luck with your opera studies there. John Davis, what do you think about, you know, why some we hear a lot still, and Gottschalk not so much? Is it because, does he span too much for our ear? Is there something too antique in his sound? What is it, John?
I think the issue in part has to do with the era in which he came from, and this is, of course, the pre-recording era, so people were not easily able to hear his music. I think it also has to do with there's a whole stream of early American pianists and composers that I'm mining, that who were ostensibly classical pianists, but who were essentially ignored or dismissed by the classical music world, but who have had an enormous impact on the development of modern popular music in America that we know well. And in fact, Gottschalk was not the only person from New Orleans writing music that was sort of on the cusp between classical music and popular and folk music of the day. In fact, there were many, many composers in New Orleans of all stripes. Some were transplanted Europeans and Americans that had gone to New Orleans to take advantage of the flourishing music publishing business going on there in the 19th century. And others were what they called Creoles, which meant a lot of different things. Initially, it meant just anything and anybody that originated in Louisiana, but eventually it referred to anybody of European descent that was born in Louisiana. And then beyond that, it also referred – it was taken up by blacks of mixed race, of mixed European and African blood, who wanted to set themselves apart from more Africans of pure blood.
Yep.
And some of these – among these Creoles of mixed race were a number of people who were very accomplished composers. Among them was a family of musicians called the Lambert family that knew Gottschalk very well. Another guy was named Basile Barrès. There was a whole host of these things, and there's lots of music that exists that also was trying to mine both the classical tradition and the popular music you were hearing of the era. Mm.
Richard, I mean, he was a prodigy out of New Orleans, played in the cathedral very early there at age, I don't know, 7 or 8. It was taken, swept off to Europe, one of the, maybe the first American to kind of get respect in the classical music world in Europe at the Paris Conservatory and beyond there. People talked about him and Chopin who brought the mazurka in, but here, Gottschalk, who brought all this vernacular music in. You say it makes him, in a way, the father of world music. It was exciting for Europeans, exciting for Americans, but was it spanning more than our ears can take, from classical and romantic to all these rhythms sometimes?
Well, he certainly knew how to turn a tune and to captivate an audience. He went to France specifically to study at the Paris Conservatory when he was 13 years old. He wasn't permitted to enroll in the school because they weren't accepting any foreigners, and the director, Zimmerman, said that nothing except barbarians came out of the United States.
And steam fitters
steam
or
locomotives.
Something. Yeah. Steam engines.
anyway, and he got even about 10 years later when he was sitting on the jury with Zimmerman for all graduates in the piano department, and he was doing concerts that Zimmerman could never have dreamt of. But he certainly was one of the first people to to bridge the folklore element of music with the concert hall, something that later Dvorak did, Copland did, Bedrich Smetana in the Czech in Bohemia. But he was the first person to see that there was benefit in incorporating that which you knew really well.
And then Latin America came in strong alongside his travels. Here's a little bit, and this is conducted by my guest Richard Rosenberg, again from the Symphony Romantique, A Night in the Tropics, a movement two performed by the Hot Springs Festival Symphony Orchestra. Kind of carnival feeling there with rhythms that many have said lay the groundwork for ragtime, big band, jazz. Here's Richard Rosenberg conducting. John Davis, we've got Richard conducting there. I mean, I'm hearing plenty going on there, ragtime-wise, big band-wise, a little Copland precursor to my ear. You're the musician. What do you hear in that? That's kind of astonishing for 1858.
Well, obviously, you're hearing all kinds of rhythms that we later associate with ragtime. You're also hearing instruments that you don't normally associate with an orchestra. I think they're using castanets and all kinds of instruments that are indigenous to Latin American countries. And this is where he really becomes the father of world music, a type of music today we refer to that incorporates the music of all different cultures, an eclectic music. But Gottschalk was one of the first people ever to do this, if not the first.
Morgan in Tampa, Florida. Thanks for calling, Morgan. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I am living in Tampa now, but I moved there from New Orleans, where I spent many years as well. But I'm a tango dancer, and in reading books about the history of tango, Gottschalk is mentioned because he wrote some habaneras that originated in Cuba, and habaneras are considered to be the precursor to not only ragtime, but also modern-day salsa and the tango.
Plenty of Gottschalk strand coming in right into the tango dancing world. Richard, what took Gottschalk down that way and into that realm that Morgan dances tango out of?
Well, he spent lots of time crisscrossing throughout the United States, Central America, and South America, and especially in the Caribbean. The danzón, or the zapateado, the dance from Cuba, was one that he used the basis of quite a bit in his music. Now, he was a student in France, along with people like Bizet, his young friend Bizet and Offenbach, and he brought the habanera to Bizet, which was then used, of course, later in Carmen. But he knew this rhythm, and he exploited it to absolutely brilliant effect. And it's something that didn't fall on deaf ears to someone like Carlos Gardel in Argentina.
John, I think you've got another piece for us you might play a bit of there on your piano in New York, this Cuban dance, the Ojos Criollos, 1859, the Cuban contradanza. Tell us about it.
It's a piece that actually features prominently the habanera rhythm, as well as the tresillo rhythm, which is sort of a variant. And it's, again, one of the early pieces that clearly draws on Latin American culture, and in fact, very much one of the first pieces to use those rhythms, in contrast to some other pieces that were written in the era that didn't seem to capture that same flavor. For instance, by Lucien Lambert, another composer from New Orleans.
Can our tango dancer Morgan from Tampa dance to what you're about to play?
Certainly to some of it.
Let's hear.
Okay.
Thank you. Wow, that's great. Roll over, Abe Lincoln. I hear a little Scott Joplin there from, what, 50 years later, maybe, John?
Certainly. Well, Joplin also employed all kinds of Latin rhythms in his music, too. So there was, as I said, there was a continuum of pianists that went from Gottschalk to that guy Blind Tom Wiggins, who I've recorded, and then through another guy named Blind Boone, all of which played the music of Gottschalk. And then this led into the ragtime era with Joplin and James Scott and all the way into the early jazz period of people like James P. Johnson and leading all the way up to Duke Ellington and people like that. So this continuum is a fascinating era that's been sort of forgotten and had an enormous influence, as I said, over the development of early American popular music.
We're very deep in the root ball here. Live from New York there, John Davis, just wonderful with that Cuban dance. Marcia in Providence, we just got a minute before the break, Marcia. What do you know?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When I was a child in New York, I saw a wonderful ballet choreographed by the great choreographer George Balanchine to the music of Louis Moreau Gottschalk.
I think
the ballet was called Cakewalk, and it was an absolute delight. And as a humorous note in the program, as I recalled, it said that the music or the costumes or something were done by Moreau and Lesso.
Louis Moreau and Lesso.
And I wonder if any of the Balanchine dancers from that era still remember that ballet and could bring it back. It was a delight.
I'm glad you bring the memory to us. Balanchine with Gottschalk there. We can certainly imagine the ballerinas up on their toes for Gottschalk. Marcia, thanks for your call. Richard Rosenberg, John Davis, please stand by. We're talking about an American original from Abe Lincoln's day, Louis Moreau Gottschalk. You can join us, 800-423-8255. Little Yankee Doodle right there in his tune. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On this day before Thanksgiving, we're talking about a real American original, pianist, composer Louis Moreau Gottschalk, son of New Orleans and a very rich and varied culture there. Civil War era composer, pre-ragtime kind of maverick, near rock star in his day. Abe Lincoln went to hear him. We'll hear about that. Behind us right here, variations on a Portuguese hymn, conducted by Richard Rosenberg, who joins us today from Dover, Delaware. John Davis is with us as well, pianist and historian, with us today very generously with a piano under his fingers, a piano keyboard, in New York City. You can join us as well. What's your question on Gottschalk on this live? Would you put him on for Thanksgiving? Invite him to your table? Can you hear America looking for, finding its early sound in the work of Gottschalk? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Knox is calling from Walterboro, South Carolina. Knox, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really interested in Gottschalk. I'm a student at the University of South Carolina, and I'm studying music, and we just studied Gottschalk and music history literally Monday. What I think is interesting is I feel like there's a lot of Berlioz even within his music. Comparing a lot of his music, even to the Symphony Fantastique, it's so programmatic. I'm very interested in why the romantic music of the United States, which is kind of forgotten and fallen by the wayside. Seems like we study Schubert, Schumann, Brahms, but we don't look at ourselves for anything of substance, which it's kind of a shame to me that we've just kind of let it fall and no one really pays attention to it anymore.
Let me put that to both of our guests. John, you first. What's your answer to student Knox's question?
Well, certainly I think from our vantage point in now the early 21st century, and certainly in the years that I grew up, which is toward the end of the 20th century, my schooling was as deficient as you are indicating in talking about composers, really any American composers. And then if we were to speak about any of them, it was the 21st century composers like Aaron Copland and the modernists, you know, people like John Cage, all of whom were absolutely marvelous. And actually, I adore their music. But the more the earlier composers of the 19th century was really forgotten territory. And again, I think there is a little bit of chauvinism in our own country toward our own. And yet I feel like this era is the era that led to all kinds of music that came later and that we need to know about it. And hopefully with people like Richard and I, that some of that will be – some of those holes will be filled, some of those gaps.
Richard, has our ear just changed? Has it turned in a different direction here? What do you say to Walter, our caller?
Well, in New England, there was certainly a prejudice against anything that was not Germanic. And in Boston, he was constantly being panned until about 1862, 63, when he actually overrode the nasty criticisms that he was receiving. There were certainly composers before Gottschalk in the United States, Anthony Heinrich, who wrote the Ornithological Symphony of the Condor. Wonderful, wonderful pieces that have been forgotten. One of the biggest problems with Gottschalk's music is that he never wrote the music down. He always had students or friends who would jot the music down for himself. The orchestral pieces he did write down. The other problem is that he was traveling so much that he often left his own music with other people to ensure its safety. And much of the music has been lost. Only recently has a lot of the music come back to light. There were two additional operas and five other orchestral pieces that I went to Cuba with my wife a couple of years ago to look for. We didn't find it. We know that it's there somewhere. So just a lot of it just fell by the wayside just because of the way Gottschalk tended his own library.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of miles of travel in an age when that was not easy to perform to his great popularity. It brings us to Lincoln, for whom he performed in 1864, I think. Of course, Lincoln, very big right now. Let's remind ourselves, here's just a little bit of Daniel Day-Lewis in Steven Spielberg's new film.
I am the President of the United States of America, clothed in immense power!
And once in a while, he needed to get away from all that. March 24th, 1864, Gottschalk performed at Willard's Hall in Washington, set aside front row seats, we read, for Abraham and Mary Lincoln. And off they went into that evening. And one of the things he performed that night, which would have been very popular and was, from what I'm reading here, in the midst of the Civil War, it's a piece of his called Union. This is a New Orleans guy who had embraced the Union, the North, and was playing for them. Richard, what about the politics of Gottschalk? We'll hear the music. What about the politics?
Well, Lincoln certainly knew the benefit of having a Southerner as a Northern sympathizer and someone as popular and as well-known as Gottschalk, and he used that relationship to his advantage. But Gottschalk was also, though he was a Southerner and though at the emancipation of the slaves, many of his relatives actually lost their fortunes, he was a Northern sympathizer. He believed in abolition. He believed in free publication for a public education for everyone throughout the Americas and often campaigned for that vigorously. But he admired Lincoln tremendously. I mean, his description of Lincoln, talking about how he looked like a grapevine covered with clothes, but that he looked like someone greatly honest and very good, and he writes that his countenance didn't attract any cause for the exterior to be forgotten. He thought
remarkably ugly, he wrote in his diary, but also with an intelligent air, he said, of the president, and eyes that exuded goodness and mildness.
But he also admired in Lincoln the fact that Lincoln, as so many men of that generation, admired a sweet tune, usually in which someone, a beautiful young maiden, had just died prematurely or something to do with butterflies. I mean, something that nowadays we would not be caught dead admiring. But Lincoln did admire many of the tunes of that period, songs of Stephen Foster. And Gottschalk really admired what Lincoln was doing. He was friends with four different presidents, from Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren, and played for Lincoln. But he also was close with George McClellan and Ulysses S. Grant.
As you suggest, had slave traders in the family, but during the war supported the North and wrote this piece, Union. He performed for Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd. We'll listen to a little bit of it right here. Patriotic mix here. It had bits of Yankee Doodle in it and the Star-Spangled Banner and a bit of Hail Columbia. We'll hear some of that. Union, Gottschalk wrote in 1862, performed in 1864 for Abraham Lincoln. Gottschalk. He played it for Abe Lincoln. He plays it for us many years later via the beauty of recording. That's Philip Martin playing his Union. Judy in Nashville, Tennessee. Judy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to add to the discussion that there's a wonderful section of about six pages on Louis Moreau Gottschalk's years in Paris in the book The Greater Journey by David McCullough.
Sure.
That just came out in 2011. And I was notified this morning that this program was on by our friend Roger Weissmeyer, who's principal English horn player and is also a pianist with Nashville Symphony. And
you remind us, David McCullough, paying close attention to Gottschalk in his big book on Americans.
That is correct.
In Paris.
And among the he was among those who were not the expatriates, as the 1920s group were, but the ones who went to Paris at the time that Louis Moreau Gottschalk did, essentially to learn and then to bring their skills back to the United States.
Judy, I'm so glad you remind us of that.
That included physicians and many other artists, authors.
The whole parade of Americans headed to Paris, Gottschalk among them. I'm so glad you remind us of that. It kind of puts it in a context here. Let me turn it in another direction. Thank you, Judy. John, here a listener says musicologists like John Joyce teaches jazz history at Tulane include Gottschalk in their jazz history. What would put him there exactly, John?
Well, I think you're in Gottschalk, you're hearing again some of the precursors of jazz that were floating around, among many composers of his era. And
I guess
the
everything
would
put him there, right? The rhythms, the melange of different traditions, the African.
Sure. Mm-hmm. The melding of African and Latin American and African American and all kinds of these traditions was a kind of a gumbo that ultimately led to the what we consider to be jazz today. And a lot of that was sown in New Orleans itself. And so you can – just by sticking with New Orleans, you can actually see that continuum that ultimately led to people like Jelly Roll Morton and Buddy Bolden and some of the really early people in New Orleans music, and obviously leading to people like Louis Armstrong.
He wrote High Work. He also wrote Potboilers that just paid the rent. The Last Hope was one of his biggest hits, followed him around. Every concert he performed, it was requested again and again. Here's a performance from that vein by pianist Alan Mendel. Thank you. Richard, this paid the rent.
It certainly did. He certainly wrote a great many potboilers. Most of them were for the publishers, and it was a way for him to pay the rent and to support the family. But he also wrote some incredibly original pieces, a wonderful melodist. You listen to the first movement of the Montevideo Symphony that he wrote in 1868. I mean, they're just beautiful tunes. And then you listen to the middle section in the trio of his Spanish operetta, Cuban Country Scenes, Escenas Campestres Cubanas, mm-hmm. and it's got to be the jazziest work ever composed before the jazz age.
He was accused of fooling around with a too young girl in San Francisco, kind of fled the country over that. I guess he was exonerated, but by that time he was in Latin America, spent many years in the Caribbean and Latin America, and actually died in Rio de Janeiro. And I guess the piece that he was performing just before his death was Mort. She is dead.
She is dead, yes.
He collapsed on the stage, I guess. Here's that. This is his 1868 piece, the last he performed. He was only 40 at his death. Rumored, what, he had malaria, maybe too much quinine? What do we know of his death, Richard?
Well, we think that it was a ruptured appendix that then translated into peritonitis, probably also combined with an overdose of quinine to treat it, so he was actually killed by the cure. But he spent his life, I mean, it was 40 great years that he had. He lived better than anyone.
Yes.
He died in Rio de Janeiro. There was some question as to about where his body should lie, and the South wouldn't have him since he did sympathize with the North. And his 9 months after his death, he was brought to New York City and buried in Brooklyn's Greenwood Cemetery.
We have this picture of him in 1865 on a ship headed up the West Coast toward Dates in San Francisco when they learned of Abraham Lincoln's assassination. And Gottschalk going to the ship's piano, along with a company of Italian singers there, playing while they sang the battle hymn of the Republic, and everybody weeping on that ship. Do we know from his diary or his writings, Richard, what he thought of his young country, America? Did he write of it, speak of it explicitly?
He was very, very disturbed that there was to be a civil war when it broke, actually months before it broke out. He compared it to a Shakespeare play in which everyone would be dead at the end of it.
Oh.
And he was embarrassed that his country that started with such noble intent ended in a way that was so divisive and so destructive. He was also very upset that on the boat, the boat that he was taking from Panama to San Francisco, that there were as many people on the boat who were mourning Lincoln's passing as who were celebrating it.
Well, he himself wrote later, "Yesterday his detractors were ridiculing his large hands without gloves," writing of Lincoln, "his large feet, his bluntness. Today," wrote Gottschalk, "this type we found grotesque appears to us on the threshold of immortality, and we understand by the universality of our grief what future generations will see in him." You, too, have helped us see a lot in Gottschalk that I had no idea about. I'm sure many others as well, and it's such a perfect delight. Richard Rosenberg, we're very grateful to you for being with us on this day before Thanksgiving to talk Gottschalk. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And John Davis, live at the piano in New York with us today. What a gift. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
John Davis, with his Halley's Comet, Around the Piano with Mark Twain, and John Davis. We'll go out with a little bit more of Gottschalk's Union. Eugene List and the Berlin Symphony Orchestra here playing a little Yankee Doodle passage there. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody on that piece of American history. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.